Hey, welcome back, everyone. Rachel here, and I'm so glad to have you join us for part three with Rabbi Kaganoff. I have so much hakaras latayif, as well as I thank all of us for being there for us, for answering us, and for directing us. Thank you so much, Rabbi Kaganoff, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. You'll forgive me, I have something in my throat. Hopefully it'll work its way through, and my speaking will become clearer. I'm going to go back first. There are a number of hashkafic, I guess, type questions that were asked from the very beginning, which have gotten pushed off because of the clarification questions. So I just think, out of fairness, I'm going to go back to those three hashkafic, I guess, questions that were asked, and then afterwards go back to the clarification questions that came in subsequently. Okay, so the first question here was, why are great sages told over, at least in my school, as perfect, when we know on guard your eyes that they were tested? Isn't being tested and flawed more human, or were these sages not so human that they were perfect? That's the question. So I'm going to give you five different possible answers on this question. Okay, the first one, I guess, is we should really be very honest. Shav Shapol Hirsch already addresses this in Parshas Lech Lecha, right at the beginning. Hirsch points out that we, as a religion, the Gemara, the Tanakh, always point out the flaws of our great people. As a matter of fact, because we're so busy pointing out the flaws, we sometimes lose sight as to who the greatness of the people are. Shaul HaMelech would be an example. We don't notice his greatness because we just see his flaws. Our verse is talking over there that the Ramban points out, beginning Parshas Lech Lecha, to make the statement that Avraham Avinu did an Aveira b'shogeg by going to Mitzrayim. So everybody jumps on that Ramban. How could you possibly say such a thing? Rav Hirsch says the Ramban is following the tradition of Chazal, right? That if there's something incorrect, you point it out to learn. And he says, and Rav Hirsch points out like this, says, the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu's humility is not because he was perfectly born that way. Moshe Rabbeinu was humble because he worked on himself. But Moshe Rabbeinu, the Medrash tells us, was naturally a hothead. For him to fly off the handle and kill the Mitzri was more in his nature, right, and then was his humility of just putting up with the complaints of the calling soul all the time. So to the contrary, it's a very important essay that he writes over there, right when at the beginning there, where he quotes the Ramban, and then he elaborates upon the Ramban's approach and Chazal's approach in general, that our great men and sages are not perfect. The contrary, we can learn from them because they were imperfect, therefore they can set as role models and examples of how we can grow. Then he proceeds to show that that we don't have to necessarily say that Avraham Avinu did a mistake there, because we can explain what he did perfectly logically and rationally. Okay, that's the overall answer. Rav Huttner used to say like this. Rav Huttner said that he used to quote the Kotzker. The Kotzker Rebbe used to say about Esav, right? He used to call Esav Uncle Esav, the Fetter Esav. And the Kotzker used to say the Fetter Esav is given ganz fine a yid. He went with a longer gatkis on a shtaimel. Ganz fine a teira by shalashidis. The Kotzker said that, for those who didn't understand it, Esav, in the outside world, Esav would have looked like a tzaddik gadol. Because the Torah reveals to us who Esav is, right? That's why we know Esav. But Esav really the way he behaved and acted, fooled Yitzchak. The only reason why Rivka wasn't fooled, because she was told ahead of time to watch out for it. That's what they said, but that's the Kotzker. We can't explain that to a child like that. You can't tell a child who sees things in black and white that that Rosh Hashiva over there is really Esav. It doesn't work. In a child's mind, it has to be black and white. In Leila, it goes like this. When we start our chinuch, right, we're taught they're the good guys and they're the bad guys, all right? And the sages are good guys, they got to be perfect. And then the bad guys, and they're all bad. Now what happens is, as we grow older, we never develop to, we never revisit these impressions and never become more sophisticated in how we look at these things. And unfortunately, the chinuch system that we see is flawed in that regard, that when we move up in the grades, whereas in the elementary school, that's how it should be taught, black and white. But when we move up into the high school level, that's when more sophisticated thinking should be brought in, and we should understand that the sages aren't all perfect, and the Roshaim aren't all bad, believe it or not. Right? Every Rosh has to have a little bit of good in him, otherwise he couldn't exist. There has to be some good. Excuse me, please. But that would be answer number two. Now, there are three other small answers, which, okay, one of this is very cynical, right? But I guess many of us here are victims of this situation, okay? There's a famous author named Machiavelli, and he wrote a book called The Prince, okay? And what that describes is a leadership which is insincere. Basically, a leadership acts a certain way in order to be able to have the respect of the public. But lo toho kabaro, what he's doing outside is really not what his inside is about. Now, unfortunately, we know too many of our communities are run by such people, all right, where we have leaders who don't live up to the standards of what the Torah really expects. And it's not that they don't, that it's b'shogeg. They do it on purpose. They want the power and control, and they use it for such. Now, as part of what they do, these less than perfect, right? These people who are just disreputable, unreputable people who are leaders in some communities, right? They want to control our thinking. So the way they control our thinking is by always teaching, right, that the great men of Israel are beyond reproach. There's nothing to ask. We don't ask questions, okay? And the Mela, therefore, you can't ask questions about them either. These disreputable, right, not ethical, unethical leaders do that in order to promote their own position. I'm going to get flack for that one, okay? Next, there's another possibility here, okay? And that is why are we always told perfectionism, okay? There's another flaw, if you will, in our means of educating, all right? There's a book called, an author named James Jones. He wrote a book called Your Children Will Whistle While They Work. It's a very important work on how to chinuch children. It's secular. It's about the secular part of life, the general part of life. Now, he writes over there that there are two great opposing beliefs about the nature of man. The first belief I'm reading here, the first belief system is that people are and ought to be free to choose for themselves in life. People inherently have the power to choose for themselves. Therefore, they learn how to avoid pain and how to achieve happiness in life by experiencing and being held accountable for the consequences of their choices. People have the power to think and believe as they choose. Therefore, they are accountable and justifiably. They should be held personally responsible for the consequences of those choices. That is one belief system about the nature of man. All right? If you believe that, then, however, having power to choose for oneself, but at the same time being inexperienced in life, obviously results in individual mistakes in a very imperfect world. Making mistakes in life and learning from experience is how we grow. It is called trial and error. It's how we learn to walk and talk. Is everything okay there? Am I okay? Hello? And ride a bike. It is one of the ways we learn things by consequences of our choices. Mistakes are part of the learning equation and not some terrible evil thing, although some mistakes have tragic results. That's the first belief system about the nature of man, that man, given free choice, will learn by experience, trial and error, what is right, what is good for him. The second belief system teaches that we people are not capable of making the right choices in life. Therefore, we must be controlled and forced to do what others believe is best for us. That's the other perspective. There are two different belief systems on how do we machanach people. Now, if I believe the second way, so I can't teach that our great people were flawed, because, I mean, they also learned by their mistakes, right? But that's not how I believe we should teach people. So I can't teach that way. So I have to teach that everybody's perfect. Okay. And then there's the last answer, which is something, excuse me. As you can understand, this is a lecture all unto itself, but I'm just being makatia, so for the sake of this session. The last answer is I address more fully in my book, in the last essay called The Chosen People. Okay, basically, our people as a whole have become such low self-esteem, which I point out in the book, and it's been that way for a couple of centuries, is that we live a facade. We don't have any tochen. We have nothing inside of us. We feel so empty inside. Everything becomes the facade outside, which is why, unfortunately, in our society, today so much is about the externals, right? What bekesh I wear, what suit I wear, how I walk, how I talk, everything on the outside as opposed to anything on the inside. Very external. And the Gedolei Yisrael all complain about this consistently, but it remains to be the same, that it's external. If we live in an external world, then everything is about what the face looks like. Well, our sages have to be our face. Our face means they got to be perfect. They have to have a face of perfectionism. So, in that milieu, I can't teach anything other than the sages are perfect. So, those are, in a short form, five basic different answers on why the education system that we have, to a large degree, teaches that our great people are all perfect. It's incorrect. It's flawed. It would be much better had we be honest and be able to be straightforward, except for the children. Little children, you can't teach that Esav was a Hasidic Rebbe or Rosh Hashiva. You can't teach that. So once we become older and more sophisticated, then it should be explored. It should be honestly dealt with exactly how to deal with all these things. Okay, next question. And this, of course, okay, second question. Why are the topics of sex, gay, masturbation, and porn all taboo? By knowing this, I assume she means by knowing details, it saves you from so many things. All these things happen because you don't know about it. Shouldn't there be education about this? It's a good question, which is why these sessions are taking place. Okay, but the answer is like this. Once upon a time, we didn't have to talk about these things. Similar upbringings of people in the same shtetl, in the same society, the same environment, without access to the larger world, the shtetl, where you were not exposed necessarily to a lot of the outside immoral influences. It was different in the big cities in Europe also. But these things are understood. There were self-understood expectations, self-understood values, mores, behavior patterns. Wasn't necessary to speak about it. In the 1980s, there was a mayor in New York, Mayor Edward Koch. Now, under his administration, there was a legislation introduced into city council, gay rights, that homosexuals should have rights. Okay, now, of course, the way it was done, crossed and everything else, but the Novodnitsky Rebbe, who was the Rosh Yeshiva at the time, and Rosh Yeshiva I was learning, he got up on a Sunday afternoon and spoke from the bima, from right in front of Yaron Kodesh. And he said, straight out, he said, no one would ever dream that we need to speak about such a sticky topic in standing in front of Yaron Kodesh. Who would ever dream of such a thing? But because it's in the outside world like this, so now we do have to speak about it. And he did. But he's a yachid. And, you know, the Novodnitsky spoke about it publicly at the time, to give us an education. How does the Torah perceive homosexual behavior and also flaunting it like it was done at that time? Now, what about today? Well, we have a holdover, which means like this. We don't have any Mesorah, how do Mechanech on these topics, right? There's no Mesorah. Two generations ago, they didn't talk about sex. They didn't talk about gay. They didn't talk about masturbation. They didn't talk about porn. They didn't talk about these things. There was no Mesorah, how are you Mechanech? So people are afraid. If I don't know how to Mechanech, maybe I'll do it wrong. Of course, that's not a good excuse, because you should do something and learn by your mistakes, to go back to question number one. Learn by the mistakes, but at least be Mechanech rather than leave people in the dark and they don't know what to do. And another reason, which is also given forth, you know, offered why we don't teach these things openly, and that is because the innocent, quote-unquote, shouldn't get ideas, quote-unquote, which is all something you'll hear in a recovery milieu as well, that people who are exposed to porn, right, so then should we send them to an SA meeting where they may hear about more daring or more outrageous sexual exploitations, which will then give them ideas, innocent ideas. So that's why we're not machanech at all about these inyanim that we just spoke, because there are people sitting in the room who may not have any dreaming about that. Now that we speak about it, they start dreaming, they think about it. So this is also not really, this is a reason given. It's not really valid. Also, the same thing is because if we don't teach it to them from a Torah perspective, people will find out through the street. That's how it goes today. So it's better that we should teach it to them and give them a Torah perspective on it than allowing the people to learn from themselves by the street, and then it comes all sorts of problems, which is exactly what you brought up here in the question. Now, the last of the hashkafic questions here, before we go down to the halacha clarification, question is like this. I know someone whose father is giving her a bad education. The father won't do basic halachos / minhagim because, quote, he doesn't have patience, unquote. I'm worried for her. Is there anything I can do, or is it out of my hands? Okay, so this question has two parts. Okay, part one is the following. You've made an assumption here, you're stating an assumption, that her father won't do basic halachos minhagim, he has no patience, bad education. So now, I need always to, when people say this, I ask, what stuff is not being done? So much in our contemporary Haredi society is considered critical to be from, when indeed all it is a custom. Unfortunately, because our lack of chinuch is such that we don't differentiate between that which is only a custom, not even a minhag, it's just a custom, right? And then becomes so important that if I don't do it, I become pashekets, that you can look as a down and judge as I'm not religious, and really it's such an unimportant little detail that we're making a big deal about. The problem with this, of course, is that because that's the perspective, so then people say, well, I don't want the baby, I don't want the bath water, I don't want anything. People don't know how to differentiate. So the first question I would ask of the person who asked this question is, let's clarify, what is it that the father is not doing, I have no patience for? Perhaps what he's saying I have no patience for is really not that important. So she is not really getting a bad chinuch per se, other than she's not being able to differentiate between what is the important, the baby, if you will, and what's the bath water, which her father's throwing away, and for her to understand that what her father is neglecting may not be so important. But that doesn't mean that therefore it should impact on things that are important. Excuse me. So, is it out of your hands or not? Well, you should be able to speak to her to say that she, give her, ask her, tell her, suggest to her that those things that your father is not doing, perhaps check out with a Rebbe, a teacher, someone who's willing to be frank and open. Are these things of such critical, does that mean that he's not religious? Or it means he's just not keeping some customs. Okay, and then there are other things which he is doing, which he is keeping, and that's what you should focus on. Or even if it is something, but let her, the friend, begin to understand that it's not an all or nothing. Yiddishkeit is far from all or nothing. And therefore, certainly if the things that are being discarded or being neglected are unimportant things, so we shouldn't get all bent out of shape, that therefore I don't have to keep everything. She has to have a chinuch. A chinuch is that, as they say, don't throw away the baby with the bathwater. Okay, those are the hashkafic questions. Let's go now to the halachic clarification. Okay, the question reads like this. What are the halachos regarding reading or fantasizing erotica about fictional characters, not Jewish? Okay, that's question one. Two, what if it is gay erotica? Okay, now, both of those would be prohibited, as we've discussed before, all right? Contemplating or thinking or reading or engaging my thought process in sexual activities, even fictional characters, right? And certainly gay, which is also gay, we said, is arroyos, okay? We'll talk further about it, is prohibited relationship. That falls under the rubric of a losa, say, called losa surach re'levavtem rachre einecha. I'm not supposed to be spending time contemplating, thinking about, ruminating about Einechem arayis, things that are erotic sexual activities. So erotica would be that, and it involves fictional characters, makes sense. It's a man and a woman that's being thought about. Gay, of course, same sex is also not permitted. Now, continues the question. If it is not okay to read, watch such explicit content, then why is it okay to read, watch about other unpermissible things? I guess she means like eating shrimp for example, murder mysteries. Or is that not permissible either? So the answer is there's difference. Okay, there are two things here. The Torah prohibits one thing. The Torah prohibits, I'm not allowed to plan to do an aveira. Machshava ra kemaisa, right? But I'm not supposed to plan to do an aveira. And that applies to all aveiras, which means I'm not supposed to be planning to murder. I'm not supposed to plan to eat shrimp. I'm not supposed to plan to eat pork. I'm not supposed to plan to do aveiras. I'm supposed to be thinking of planning to do it. That's what all aveiras say. Then there's another issue, which is lo sasur acharei levavchem. That lo sasur, which was in Parshat Sittes, lo sasur, right, applies to three specific things. Acharei levavchem is avodah zara. Acharei einechem is arayas. Asher atem zonim azu minus. It applies to three topics. Idolatry, forbidden sexual behavior, which is incest, adultery, and the subdivisions thereof, which we will discuss yet more with some of the questions today, will define that more. And then minus apikoresis. So I'm not allowed to, even I'm not planning to do it. So for example, I'm not allowed to be thinking about, just contemplating the concepts of the Indian, about the modern day India, right? The Avodah Zorahs that they have there. Just to think about it and contemplate. I'm not planning to do it. Just to think about it, to study it. It's usher. Okay, that's the sasur. I'm not supposed to do that. Nothing to think about it, even if I don't plan to do it. The same thing with the arayas. All right. These things that fantasizing about erotica, thinking of these things which we spoke about, pornography, fantasizing, all right, in the arayas, in the forbidden sexual relationship arena is also part of the sasur. It's the second class. And therefore, I'm not supposed to be thinking about it, even on no plan. And then the last part is minus apikoresis, likewise, to think, right, anything contrary to the 13 ikrim of the Rambam, right, to think maybe it is, maybe it isn't, or philosophize about it and contemplate back and forth, that also would be included in the los asuru. However, it would not apply to, for example, murder, right? You want to read a murder mystery, well, it may be causing, that's a midos issue. In other words, it's causing me callous to the concept of human life. but that's not machshava ra, that's not lo sasuru as far as the Torah is concerned. Next question. What is the halacha regarding women acting out on SSA? Okay, let's finish the question. We know it is not permissible for two men to pursue a sexual relationship, but is it mutter for two women to touch sexually, kiss, or more? The answer is no. It's not mutter, and it's also a Torah prohibition. It's the Torah says in the introduction, in Kapitel Yud Ches in Vayikra, chapter 18 in Vayikra, Parsha Achrimot is an introduction to the Parsha of the Arroyos, which we read on Yom Kippur afternoon. It says, we're not supposed to do like Masa Eretz Mitzrayim, or Kamasi Eretz Kanan, Asher Atem Boim Shama, or the like, the activities, actions of the Bnei Kanan, as we're coming to, also you should not do. What are these actions? The Rashi brings that a woman would marry a woman, a man would marry a man, they'd marry animals. So same-sex activity, right, like we described last time, the same-sex attraction is not something that we can legislate out of existence. The person is challenged with that, it's an isayon, they have to deal with it according to the halacha, as we discussed last time or the time before. Acting out upon it, that's what the Torah prohibits. Okay, and that would be apply as well for women, lesbians, who have the same sex attraction. So they would not be allowed to touch sexually, to kiss sexually, right, or any of the other activities that are sexual activities. They would not be allowed. It would be a lo sase because, of course, there's no penetration, so there would not be any nisas bezdin, but it still is nevertheless prohibited, and it is a deraita. Next question. Is it halachmi mutter for a single girl to break her own hymen by self-done penetration. Okay, there is no prohibition for a woman to do this to herself. Any difference, I should say, than cutting herself, right? Or maiming herself. It is, in halachic, let's put it this way, it is, it is considered a marriage defect not to be a virgin, okay? And that needs, now, it could be that it happens spontaneously, or a woman does it for herself, but she's, the term in Hebrew, in Lashon Kodesh, is called a mukas et. It means that her hymen has been broken not through a sexual relationship. Now, such a change in status would need to be reported to the husband has to know before he gets married that he's not marrying a woman who has a hymen. Okay? The ksuba, right, in the text of the ksuba, there's one text of a ksuba and one commitment, or ksuba commitment, that's made when the girl, when the woman marrying is a virgin. That means including with a hymen, an intact hymen. She's called a besula. A woman who does not have the hymen is technically not called a besula. She's called a mukas et, all right? And the ksuba text is different. Now, it would be similar also if a woman was violated before marriage, okay? So she's not a basula. Now, we know oftentimes when the husband is told such a thing, he doesn't really care so much, so they write suba as if she was a basula, all right? So that could happen here too. But it is technically a defect that she would have to prove. It's like any other flaw, right? If a person, let's say, would have a blemish on her body. So it's not the first thing she puts on her resume, but sometime during the course of the dating, the husband has to know that when she'll disrobe, there's going to be a blemish there. I mean, otherwise he'll say, that I was fooled. I was deceived, right? It can cause all sorts of shalom bias issues, all right? So the answer to this question is that halakhli mutter for a single girl to break her own hymen if it's for a necessity, right? Yes, it's okay, right? He should be told about it, all right? But not, like, it's not on the resume. It's not the first thing you tell the husband. Oh, by the way, that's not what it means on the course of the dating, like other character defects that we need to report. At a certain point in the dating process, it's supposed to be revealed. So not at a point where it'll chase him away, but also not at a point where it's already too late and he's head over heels and he's going to say, listen, you deceived me, you fooled me. Now, I'm sort of, as I'm reading the question and discussing, I'm sensing that perhaps the questioner is asking a different sort of question. There are women who are born without vaginas. Okay, there are women that, I forget what the type of the disorder is called. There is a disorder, I think it's 1 in 1,000 women who have such a disorder. Now, in order for them to have chasna properly, they have to create for themselves a vagina. Otherwise, there can't be a regular sexual relationship, right? So, in so doing, in order to, and they can do it, it can be done mechanically how they create for themselves a vagina, but it involves breaking the hymen. Now, if that was the question, then of course she has to do it in order to prepare herself for chas. Okay, but I'm not sure if that was the question. The question may have just meant for without that condition. Without that condition, the answer I gave is what I told you, is that it would be permissible, but it's considered a flaw, a blemish, and that would have to be something reported to the husband sometime before, at some point during the prospective husband, and sometime during the course of the shidduch function. Okay. Next question. A romance movie. May I watch a movie scene where a man and woman kiss? Well, it may be pornography. It may not be pornography. In other words, if it doesn't give you an arousal, just part of the movie, pass along, fine. If it's something more, then of course then it gets involved in the issue of pornography, which is not permitted. May I watch a scene where it shows before and after the act, undressing, foreplay, but not the act itself? Well, we just already answered that question. The answer is no. Ashatem zonim acharehem. It's both a sur. We're not supposed to be doing that. Okay. Next question. Slightly different topic. My husband is dysfunctional in many areas and has always rejected going to therapy or a rav. I've been married for many decades, and had never climaxed with him or felt any closeness or connection from the sexual act. He always considered any discussion or needs to be unfrum. From the first moment of foreplay until he fell asleep afterwards, not one word was ever exchanged. The sexual relation has been a source of tremendous emotional pain and rejection, and has left many deep scars in my neshama. After one rejection too many, I finally stopped going to mikvah. This has helped alleviate some of the fear I used to have that at any moment he could come to my bed. Am I wrong to have taken such a drastic step? The answer is no. It would have been better had you asked Shaila first from the proper rav. But I don't know if you would have found the proper rav. You probably told him to just keep doing it. But no, you were being raped. This is what we call statutory rape, which means that technically there's consent, but it's really rape because she doesn't want it happening. In halacha, statutory rape is called a mefuta pitui, all right? But it's in the secular law, it's called statutory rape, okay? And a woman does not have to, a woman should not submit herself to marital rape. What should be done in this situation? Well, that's a separate question, but no, based on what you're telling me here, had you asked me the Shaila what to do, I would have said that if your husband refuses to go for therapy, for marital therapy, on the sexual therapy, so then you do not have to go to mikvah. You should not have to go to mikvah. You don't go to mikvah. Now, next part of her question, does the Rav have any suggestions as to how I can heal emotionally? Intimacy is meant to be a source of utmost connection between husband and wife. For me, it was utter loneliness and rejection. Yeah, to heal emotionally would be for you to undergo trauma therapy. You're the victim of serial rape, hostage serial rape. I'm sorry to use such harsh language, but if we call a diagnosis by its real name, so then you know where you can get help. Havdil is no different had you been kidnapped and raped at will, right, with no say, and being held hostage and you have nothing to say about it. Okay, you submitted to it, so it's statutory, but basically you are a rape victim, and there are therapies, it's trauma therapy, inner child work, where a rape victim the rape victim learns how to regain the loss of self, loss of control over their body, the loss of self, all the emotional injuries that you've sustained because, as you described, there's hope. There is hope. The hope is to engage. You have to find the right therapist. It's not just talk therapy, all right? It's deeper therapy because the injuries are very deep emotionally, not subjected to necessarily talking to them, as we described before. In my book also, I describe a little bit more about that type of therapy. But it's a therapy that goes deeper into the soul. It requires the new modalities of trauma therapy, which have been developed over the last 15, 20 years. Next question. There are times when I am having thoughts of having pleasure as a result of someone abusing me. I am going to therapy. These thoughts come up during intimate relations with my husband, sometimes making me more excited. Sometimes if I prepare myself properly beforehand, I don't have these thoughts. Sometimes even with the preparation, I have these thoughts. When I'm not able to prepare myself properly, I'm too embarrassed to tell my husband that I can't be with him because I'm having these thoughts. So I end up being intimate with him. So is this a problem? To be with him and I have these thoughts, to be excited by them. Do I need to tell him that I am not able to be with him when I am in that state, that I am pretty sure that I will have those thoughts? That's the question. Okay. Let's get a little background here and then answer the questions. Okay? There are four reasons to have sex during marriage. They all overlap. There are four reasons. Reason one, of course, is to beget children. You cannot become pregnant unless you have sex. Then there's a different reason. Nothing to do with having children. It's about bonding. Okay? I use the word make love, so everyone thinks make sex. I don't. Make love means that I use the intimate connection to create a loving bond between husband and wife. That is a, not only, that's a l'chatchila activity. It's not just like the wrong attitude is that, well, sex is only for having children, otherwise it's not a nice thing. It's a bad. No, that's not how the Torah looks at it. The Torah looks at it that the biggest mitzvah is pure rivia. course, having children, begetting children. But right below that, not too much below that, is the idea of having two separate beings bond into one unit. And that's the love. That's love that becomes because of the sex act. That's reason number two. Then there's reason number three and four, which are lower on the hierarchy, but are kosher. And that is, number three, she should have pleasure. And number four, he should have pleasure. Now, you notice I divide that into two, which means that she may want to have pleasure, and he's not interested, right? But he has an obligation to give her pleasure. Now, it can't get, like everything else, the last three and four shouldn't get out of hand here, but if she has a desire, right, to have sex, he's not interested. He has a mitzvah to be able to give her her pleasure. And it goes the other way around, too. If he would like to have sex, right, but she's not in the mood. But he, now, this, of course, is when we have a properly functioning couple, so there are discussions between, listen, honey, I'd like to be together tonight. She says, I'm not up to it. Okay, can we make an appointment for tomorrow night? Okay, there are conversations, or there can be negotiations. Caring goes back and forth, right? But those are legitimate reasons to have sex also. Just she would like to be have pleasure, and four, he would like to have pleasure. Independent. Of course, if it then develops into the bonding, that's tremendous. That's great. Okay, now, and of course, they overlap. You don't have, usually one does not engage just in having children without the bonding happening or there's pleasure involved. All right, now. But that is background. Oh, by the way, another aside. Once upon a time, not too long ago, in the from Hasidic families, the term shalom bayis was used as a euphemism for sex. That's what was meant, right? And when they used to ask the kala during the week, via shalom bayis, right, what they meant was, how is sex? I mean, I've seen the Gadol Yisrael get irate and angry at the Rebbetzins when they start talking that way, because it's prost. You're using a nice term, but it's really prost. It's very vulgar. Don't talk about it like that. All right? But number two through four that I listed, the bonding, the pleasure, is the shalom bayis aspect. It's what is understood will help a shalom bayis issue. Once upon a time, when there was full understanding of Hakaras HaTov, it did. Today, where people are very selfish oftentimes, having a pleasurable experience in bed doesn't necessarily help shalom bayis. Okay, now that being said, let's talk about this lady's question here about stray thoughts, all right? Thoughts of pleasure of, abuse. The pleasure that was generated because someone abused her. Okay, now, there's the Ikar HaDin, as we discussed so many times here, there's the main halacha, okay? And then there are the Inyane Kedusha, right? Kedoshim Tiyu, okay? And then there's also a differentiation between the beginning of the children, the pregnant, impregnation, becoming pregnant, right? And then the other times that sex is engaged, and the other two to four, that with numbers two to four, which we mentioned. Now, the Ikar HaDin, right, it makes no difference what's going on in the mind, okay, while the sexual act is going on. It doesn't make a difference, right? The idea over here is either to have the children, which of course, right, is an act, right? He puts sperm into her body and her ova is fertilized and there's a baby, okay? Now, we'll come in a minute to the Kedusha part of that, okay? So, and the bonding aspect is also, and the pleasure aspect is all, the physical act. Now, there's a din of Kedusha, right? The Kedusha is HaMachshava, which is what's taught to all of us, and appropriately so, because we're not animals, right? And the idea over here is, well, we shouldn't be animals. Unfortunately, anyone who's on this line, right, has been unfortunately exposed to human behavior, which is animal-like, unfortunately, without that kedusha aspect, without that dignity aspect of a human being, and therefore we are in the place we are and why we are in the programs that we're at. But that's because of some influence that has been brought to bear upon us. Now, the kedusha's machshava is something that we're taught, that we should try to, besides being as a dignified human being, we should also try to raise the level of this act into something of an Avodas Hashem type of behavior. Now, and that's where all these rules and ideas and concepts about regulating what I'm thinking about while I'm involved in it. Now, we, I think, can understand easily a differentiation. If the woman is fertile at the moment, and in the time of the act it could be get a child, we definitely would want very much to have a holier machshava, a more pure machshava, because the neshama being brought into the world at this moment, right, is we want to be to have the best shot possible. Now, we shouldn't beat ourselves up if we aren't able to do that. You know why? Take a look through the world and you'll see how many tzaddikim, gedolim are born of parents who are rishayim. Look at all the Bali Tshuva that have come back to Yiddishkeit whose parents didn't keep Taras HaMishpacha. So they are Nida. Their mother was a Nida and they were born to their Ben or Bas Nida. Okay? I don't think it's wrong to reveal the following, that Shlomo Volba, that great Mashkiach, Tzaddik, Zadar, Shlomo Volba was a Bal Tshuva. Right? His parents didn't keep Taras HaMishpacha. When it came time for him to do a shidduch, right? He was a very eligible bocher, chashuv bocher in the Mir Yeshiva, and he married into a very chashuv mishpacha, the Shapir mishpacha, Einichlach from a Chaim Voloshina. The Chaznish was consulted. The Chaznish consulted, he's a Ben Nida. And the Chaznish, in his inimitable fashion, Torah Mitzaharis. The fact that he's Chaim Torah Mitzvahs now, it's Mitzahar, it gets rid of all that. What happened to all this daily machshava and things that are supposed to have happened when his parents were, so their answers given about that too. But the bottom line is, they were secular Jews. They were assimilated Jews in Germany. That's who his parents were. Nevertheless, Shlomo Volba came from Shlomo Volba. So with all our desires of having tushin and machshava to influence how the children come out, the bottom line is, the Rebbe runs the world. That's all, right? And if I can do it, I can do it. It's Kedusha. It's not the Iker Hadin. And then, of course, that's if she's fertile. And if she's not fertile, and it's not going to cause an impregnation. It's about the bonding, right? And it's about the pleasure. Well, if it's the pleasure, so then what I'm thinking really is irrelevant, because she would like to be pleasure. I can't control my thinking. I'm thinking about another woman. Okay, so she would like her pleasure, so I have an obligation to let her have her pleasure, right? And I can't control my thoughts, but why should I deny her Torah right because I can't do a frumkeit? And the same thing is reversed. The husband has a right to have pleasure, and a wife should be able to give it to him. For her to refrain from doing so because she can't control her thoughts on the kedusha level, which is really a frum level, but she's denying him a basic Torah right, right? Bnei Mominus, it's like almost, it's a Ben Adol Havero right that he has. So why? So, therefore, the answer to your questions, right, are that, yes, you should try to work on your therapy and you should try to work on controlling the thoughts, but, you know, these type of responses are something that are very difficult to relearn or control once the damage has been done, which is what happened. You were abused as a child, right? So it's there. So you have to do the appropriate therapy, and I hope you're seeing the right trauma therapist to be able to root out and be able to gain control of your life and what you think. But in the meantime, no, certainly if you should not be telling him and spoil his experience, you shouldn't tell him that. Right? You should try to prepare, and if you don't prepare, it's okay. You do it because it's a mitzvah. What you're doing, the act you're doing is a mitzvah. Even if the machshava isn't there, you can't get the machshava into gear with the maisa. It would be, for example, to take to eat matzah on Seder night, right? If I can, there are all the machshavas and things I'm supposed to, kavanas I'm supposed to think while eating the matzah. And if I can't, I still eat the matzah. I still get the mitzvah deraisa. I just didn't think all those wonderful machshavas. So I hope that clarifies that point. All right, next question. A few more questions here. Oh, we only have two more questions, I think. Okay. What is the Torah perspective for halakhic view on a divorced or widowed woman? They've all had relations in the past, and masturbation, if it isn't a safe for therapeutic purpose. Whether or not they've had relations before or not is not relevant to the question itself, all right? One could think, but it's not. It's about the question of sexual stimulation, not with the husband, right? That's your question, okay? And as we said before, it's mutter, all right? It's mutter, all right? But the Kedusha aspect is, as we said also, Kedoshim to you, right? The levels of Kedusha that one should aspire to, that one should not have to need this, right? If there's another alternative, that, again, as we spoke about the whole concept of Kedusha, of Chumras, right? We do Chumras, and it brings today that I have resentment, and it causes less love of Hashem and less Yirat Shemayim, so then it's counterproductive to what the whole purpose of the Chumra was, as we discussed. Next one. Okay, actually, this is the last one. Oh, so we will have enough time. Baruch Hashem. Okay, my question. Okay. I know that penetration is an issur d'oraisa, but what about anal? Okay, so now the question here is really very short, and I think we need to give some background first. Well, let's answer the question. Okay, anal sex, all right? The Torah perceives anal sex is exactly the same as vaginal sex. There's exactly no difference halakhically between the two, except for one aspect. And one aspect about ejaculation. Right, a husband is allowed to ejaculate. That's the mitzvah, to ejaculate within the vagina, but he's not allowed to ejaculate in the anus. That's usur, prohibited, except in pikuach nefesh cases. But other than that, it's not permitted. But I think we need to back up here something. When she said penetration is issur d'oraisa, so I'm assuming that she understands that to be in a case of when she's a nida, okay, any arayas, adultery, incest, or equally so, I assume she means also, as we've discussed before, it's also to have sex outside of marriage, which means a single and a singleton, right, even if she is not a nida, right, but if they're not formally married, they don't have chuppah v'kiddushin, sex is usur. All right, so I assume that she was asking an issur d'oraisa on all of those aspects, whether nida, arayas, or a penuyas, it's called, someone who there's no chuppah v'kiddushin, I'm assuming. Now, so I think we need to add some other things here, okay? First of all, the word penetration may be a little bit not understood properly. Okay, halakhically, penetration does not mean that his entire organ has to go into her vagina. Halakhically, penetration is once the crown, the atara, it's called, the top part of his organ, enters into the beginning of her vagina, that already is an issur d'oraisa, all right? The chayav kares, mitzvas bezdin, lotzaseh, that's already, it's called, it's called nashikas eva, just the beginning is already what the Torah prohibits. So penetration does not mean all the way in. Okay, so we have to understand that. One. Two. Even foreplay in arayas is also an issur d'oraisa. Torah says, osikrivu legalos erva, which means you're not supposed to engage in activities, right, which are the precursor to sex, even if it doesn't go there. So, for example, to have an arousing experience with a member of the other sex, even that we're not going to go any further, right? Hugging, kissing, that also is a los, let's say, los sikrivu legalos ervo. And it's a deraisa, according to the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch seems to pass in that way too. Sikrivu legalos ervo is a deraisa. So when you say, I know the penetration is a deraisa, right, so those two caveats. First of all, there can be assumed deraisa even without penetration, right? Someone shouldn't think, well, I don't penetrate, then it's okay. No, it's not so, right? First of all, it doesn't have to be full penetration. It's already the kareis. And the Mises Bezdin aspect, the Nida of Kareis, that's already just by the beginning, right? Nishika Sever, that's called. And then also that even without any penetration whatsoever, Losikrivu is also a deraisa. But as far as the question, as far as anal sex is concerned, halachically, anal and vaginal is exactly the same, with that one exception, which is about the ejaculation, which I discussed. Okay, Rahulia, that's the end of the questions I have. I don't know if you want to just stand here or if you want to open. I think we have about 10 minutes or so. See if there are any questions from the floor. But otherwise, I think we've concluded the questions that have been given to me.